content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 26, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows kind of a mad scientist laboratory. There is a surprised-looking Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, leaning back. And on the table is a Frankenstein monster coming up from his ropes, tearing him, looking really fierce, and he's wearing a Facebook T-shirt. The title is Facebook's Regrets, Why Zuckerberg Wants to Shrink His Site's Giant Influence on News and Politics. So we'll go to the main stories and how they were covered, starting with the battle over keeping the government open. What happened? Congressional Republican leaders were scrambling to avoid a government shutdown this week after President Trump's outburst about allowing immigrants from, quote, shithole countries appeared to extinguish hopes for a bipartisan agreement that would have included both spending and immigration. Having passed a stopgap measure in December, Congress had until midnight on Friday, after the week went to press, to pass a bill allocating new funds to keep the government operating. With Republicans needing Democratic votes in the Senate, Democrats demanded that any spending agreement include a permanent fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, an Obama-era policy that exempted from deportation about 700,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought into the U.S. as children. Trump dismantled DACA in September and gave Congress until March to negotiate a replacement. Senators Richard Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, and Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, negotiated an agreement giving DACA recipients, known as Dreamers, legal status and a path to citizenship in exchange for additional border security funding and changes to the visa system. But in a contentious White House meeting, Trump rejected the proposal, reportedly asking why U.S. should continue to accept immigrants from shithole countries such as Haiti. Republican leaders decided to give up on DACA for now and instead proposed a stopgap measure to keep the government funded for 28 days. The bill contained two sweeteners, a six-year extension of the popular Children's Health Insurance Program and a delay in the implementation of some Affordable Care Act taxes. With no imminent deadline on immigration, said Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, there is no reason why Congress should hold government funding hostage. What the editorial said. The Graham-Durbin proposal is, or was, a reasonable compromise, said the Washington Post, in exchange for fixing DACA, a move backed by large majorities of Americans in both parties. It would have provided $2.7 billion of funding for beefed-up border security, more than half of it for Trump's beautiful wall. It would also have reshaped the diversity lottery system, allocating half of the program's 55,000 visas on a merit-based system and the rest to foreign nationals living in the U.S. under temporary protected status. Alas, after initially praising the bill, Trump reversed himself after talking to anti-immigration aides and lawmakers. Our mercurial, malleable, and malevolent president is impeding good faith attempts to solve a problem he caused himself. It's always easy to blame Trump, said the Washington Examiner, but the truth is Democrats want an argument rather than action. They know that in a crucial election year, immigration is far more powerful as a live issue than it is as an accomplishment in the rearview mirror. and they know that doing deals with Trump would make his presidency more successful, harming their hopes of a blue wave in November's midterms. That's why they're digging in their heels. What the columnist said. Trump's remark was reprehensible, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. But what the Democrats did is worse. They knew that leaking Trump's profanities would spark an uproar, rendering further negotiations all but impossible and leaving the Dreamers in continued limbo. But they couldn't resist an opportunity to publicly embarrass the president. All they care about is getting Donald Trump, no matter who gets hurt. Democrats should let Trump have his border wall, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. The president is so desperate to fulfill his signature campaign promise that he'll give his opponents almost anything they want in exchange for something he can call the wall, even if it's mostly upgrades of the status quo. If Democrats play this right, Trump is willing to fall into their arms. Trump is certainly eager to prove what a great negotiator he is, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But he is severely hampered by his allergy to policy detail. On health care, infrastructure, and now immigration, he has repeatedly expressed what he wants to do, only to be overruled by Congress or his aides, who know he is so clueless about policy that he will accept whatever they tell him. How can you make a deal with a president who doesn't understand anything about the deal beyond his belief that deals are good? And not surprisingly, our controversy of the week is titled "Shithole Countries, Proof That Trump Is a Racist?" It's time to say it without excuses, without evasions, without caveats, said Scott Lucas in CNN.com. Donald Trump is a racist. Last week, the president, in an Oval Office discussion with senators about a bipartisan immigration compromise, flared into anger when he heard Democrats mention the need to admit some people from Haiti, El Salvador, and various African nations. Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here, he asked. It would be better, Trump added, to get immigrants from places like Norway. After Democratic Senator Dick Durbin leaked the comments to reporters and Republican Senator Lindsey Graham confirmed them, Trump offered a vague denial that was backed by two GOP senators, Tom Cotton and David Perdue. Reportedly, the paper-thin pretext that the word they heard was actually shit house. Trump's racism is hardly news, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. He spent 2 years stroking the ridiculous birther story theory that President Obama was born in Africa, launched his campaign vowing to keep out rapist Mexicans, and has waged endless Twitter vendettas against black, Hispanic, and Muslim people who dare to differ with him. With last week's comparison of shithole countries with Norway, however, he's proven that the reactionary heart of Trumpism is white nationalism. Could Trump have chosen his words more carefully? Said Wade Allen Root in Las Vegas Review-Journal. Yes, but who cares? Once again, the president has said exactly, although crudely, what 63 million taxpayers who voted for him were thinking. Why would a country already $20 trillion in debt and lacking enough jobs for its workers open its doors to low-skilled immigrants escaping Haiti, El Salvador, and the failed states of Africa? Trump's salty language horrifies our snowflake intellectuals, said Scott McKay in Spectator.org. But Haiti and El Salvador really are shitholes, hotbeds of corruption, violence, and crime. Immigrants from these countries are less likely to arrive with skills and qualities ensuring their positive participation in our society. It's not racist to say so. The intellectual contortion of Trump's defenders are embarrassing to watch, said David French in NationalReview.com. Yes, some countries are worse places to live in than others, and there are reasonable arguments to be made for a merit-based immigration policy. But the president explicitly said we should judge immigrants based on their country of origin, rather than on their individual skills and education level. Trump has it backwards, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. Immigrants from dysfunctional countries self-select and burn with ambition to advance themselves and join the American miracle. Our nation was built by waves of immigrants fleeing the countries of their day. None of us can know Trump's private thoughts or motivations, said David Linhart in the New York Times, but his record in public life is abundantly clear. In 1973, Trump was sued for refusing to rent apartments to blacks. In 1989, he demanded the death penalty for five black and Latino youths accused of rape and stuck with that position even after DNA evidence exonerated them. Then came birtherism, his repellent both sides comments after Charlottesville, and his repeated venomous attacks on Muslims and African Americans. Loyalty to Trump now consists of defending the indefensible, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. In trafficking in racial stereotypes, fear, and division, Trump has revealed who he is. My fellow Republicans, now we reveal who we are. Have we no remaining decency and self-respect? And time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for legal tender, with the news that Nevada's notorious Bunny Ranch brothel may soon accept Bitcoin. Owner Dennis Hoff says many of his clients are wealthy, so using an anonymous cryptocurrency is a natural fit for people who have much to lose. It was a good week for a dish served cold after former NBC Today journalist Ann Curry, forced from the show's co-anchor job after allegedly clashing with colleague Matt Lauer, said in an interview she is not surprised Lauer was brought down by allegations of sexual harassment and abuse. She declined to elaborate. And it was a good week for decluttering after three New Jersey brothers found a tiny, dust-covered painting in the basement that turned out to be an early Rembrandt worth $1.1 million. As a kid, I thought, why did we have a painting like that in our dining room, said Ned Landau. But it was a bad week for giving both sides after a Milwaukee Christian elementary school apologized for a fourth grade homework assignment asking students to list three good reasons for slavery and three bad ones. It was a bad week for Senator Richard Shelby after fellow Alabama Republicans launched a drive to censure him for failing to support the Senate candidacy of Roy Moore. After multiple women alleged Moore harassed or molested them as teens, Shelby said he would write in another Republican, which critics say was an act of disloyalty. Finally, it was a bad week for thrift when a British man tried to evade excess baggage fees on a flight home from Iceland by wearing 10 shirts and 8 pairs of pants. Staff prevented a bulkily clad Ryan Williams from boarding the British Airways flight, but refunded his ticket. And before we move from here, let's take this boring but important item. The uninsured rate jumps. The number of Americans without health insurance increased by 3.2 million in 2017. The first annual increase since the insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act were created in the fall of 2013. Under the ACA, the uninsured rate fell to a record low of 10.9% at the end of 2016. Last year, it rose 1.3 percentage points to 12.2%. The biggest driver of the change, Gallup said, is that fewer people bought their own insurance, possibly because of Republican promises to repeal the individual mandate, which was effectively eliminated with the tax bill in December. The Trump administration has also cut back on promoting the health exchanges. On the briefing page, we have the fight over U.S. national monuments. The Trump administration is pursuing a major rollback of federal land protections, prompting a furious response. What's at stake? The fate of millions of acres of federal land. Last month, President Trump slashed the size of two national monuments in Utah by 2 million acres, reversing, he said, a massive federal land grab by former Presidents Clinton and Obama. The Red Rock Canyon country of Bears Ears will shrink by 85%. Grand Staircase Escalante, meanwhile, will be halved. These reductions came after a major lobbying campaign by the uranium industry. In addition to the Utah monuments, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has recommended that Trump shrink or modify another 8 national monuments created since 1996, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the California's fir forests. These decisions have sparked a fierce battle between those who believe local residents and the free market should decide whether federal lands in a given state are developed, and conservationists who believe the nation's remaining wilderness areas belong to the American public. The Trump administration is walking into a legal, political, and moral minefield, says Kate Kelly, public lands director for the Center for American Progress. How are monuments created? Unlike national parks, which can only be designated by Congress, national monuments are established with the stroke of a presidential pen. Under the Century-Old Antiquities Act, presidents have the authority to preserve landmarks and other objects of historic or scientific interest that are already under federal control, so long as they limit them to the smallest area compatible with proper care and management. Originally designed to protect against the looting of ancient artifacts, the act has since been used by 16 presidents, both Republican and Democratic. But conservatives say Clinton and Obama abused the act far beyond its intended purpose, creating mega monuments that have locked up huge swaths of the West from traditional land uses, such as hunting and grazing. Obama protected 553 million acres during his presidency. His 29th monument, Bears Ears, was established shortly before he left office, causing an uproar in San Juan County. Why is that? Many Utahns saw Obama's move as a betrayal. San Juan is one of the poorest counties in Utah, a state where more than 60% of the land is controlled by Washington. Residents already have to deal with a long list of federal restrictions, and many felt the Obama administration was depriving them of their livelihoods and much-needed revenue by closing off another 1.35 million acres, an area the size of Delaware, of oil, gas, and uranium-rich land. The Antiquities Act is supposed to protect specific objects, said San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman, not millions of acres. What do conservationists say? They argue that tourism and outdoor recreation bring more money into a community than traditional uses of land. A study of 17 national monuments by independent nonprofit Headwaters Economics found that every local economy expanded in every single case after the monument was established. Unlike mining and fossil fuel drilling, Trump's critics add, tourism preserves America's natural heritage for future generations. Native American activists contend that his bear's ears decision alone threatens some 100,000 sites of archaeological importance, including grave sites and ancient cliff dwellings, while uranium mining also threatens drinking water. It's a historical trauma our people have been through over and over, Helaman Thor Hale, a local Native American, told the New York Times. Will they fight the decision? A number of advocacy groups have already filed legal challenges, and if Trump targets monuments outside of Utah, the fight will expand and intensify. Rural parts of Utah, Nevada, and Idaho are currently a hotbed of resistance to federal control. That resistance exploded in 2014 when Nevada-based cattle rancher Cliven Bundy led an armed standoff with law enforcement over unpaid federal grazing fees, and continued 2 years later when his son seized the headquarters of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. But Trump's rollback faces a much chillier reception in the West's blue states. California's attorney general has already vowed to launch a legal challenge if Trump touches the state's national monuments, arguing that the president doesn't have the authority to do so. What does the law say? That has yet to be decided by the courts. Some legal experts say the wording of the Antiquities Act makes it a one-way ratchet, only directly authorizing presidents to create monuments, not reduce or abolish them. But in practice, previous presidents have shrunk national monuments 18 times, including during World War I, when Woodrow Wilson halved the size of Mount Olympus National Monument to provide timber for Navy ships. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy slightly downsized Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico. No one legally challenged those decisions, however. Trump's attempted rollback will force courts to settle the dispute over Antiquities Act's wording, says the law professor James Rasband. A new chapter in the meaning of the act may be about to be written, he says. We're going to take a slightly different tack this week and read the best business columns rather than the more politically oriented columns. The first one, reaching back to our cover picture with Mark Zuckerberg, says tech, fixing Facebook's fake news problem. Facebook has a startling new ambition, said Casey Newton in TheVerge.com. It wants to shrink. Stung by criticism that it fueled the rise of fake news and contributes to depression among its users, the world's biggest social network last week announced major changes to its core feature, the news feed, to encourage more meaningful interactions. Posts shared by friends and family, or ones that garner lots of comments, will now be prioritized over those from news outlets and brands. In practice, it means you'll see more baby pictures and vacation updates and fewer articles and viral quizzes. CEO Mark Zuckerberg concedes people might start spending less time on the site as a result, and they'll click on fewer ads. But he insists that's fine if it means happier, more engaged users. The 33-year-old billionaire has clearly been doing some soul searching, said Mike Isaac in the New York Times. He recently admitted he had been too dismissive of concerns that fake news helped swing the 2016 election. What matters to him now, he said, is that his two young daughters grow up feeling that what their father built was good for the world. Facebook's return to its roots is not without risk, said Barbara Ortute in the Associated Press. Users who have been put off by toxic content may be uninterested in returning, and those who have come to rely on the social network as a source of news will now have to look elsewhere. But with a $522 billion market cap, Facebook can probably afford the financial pain that will come from fewer advertising eyeballs. And over the long term, a happier user base could translate into increased profits. At least that's what the company hopes. There are fears, however, that these changes will simply reinforce users' filter bubbles, said Maya Kosoff in VanityFair.com. When Facebook recently experimented with stripping out media articles from news feeds in Slovakia, Guatemala, Cambodia, and elsewhere, it actually increased the spread of fake news. That the company would now make this change, knowing the potential ramifications, suggests it might be trying to shift its misinformation problem from its algorithm to friends and family. Still, this is the right move for Facebook and for media organizations, said Will Oramus in Slate.com. Over the past 5 years, Facebook has radically changed how news is created, distributed, and consumed. And as the site's profits have mushroomed, public trust in the media has plummeted. Turning off the spigot of Facebook traffic will give the news industry a chance to return to basics, serving their readers rather than pandering to them for clicks, likes, and shares. Sure, but no change is ever simple when 2 billion humans are involved, said Charlie Wartzel in BuzzFeed.com. Like it or not, Facebook is central to how we live now, having reshaped the media and political landscape. It's rewired our lives in unknowable ways, and that makes the company's retreat feel less like a selfless act and more like an abdication of civic responsibility. Why the Bitcoin bubble will burst. There are bubbles, there are bad investments, and then there's Doggy Coin, said Matt O'Brien, a joke digital currency created in 2013 in homage to Shiba Inu dogs. Doggy Coin was never meant to be worth anything. But because the financial world has cryptocurrency mania, thanks to Bitcoin, Doggy Coin was recently valued at $2 billion. If you need more proof that digital currencies might be the biggest bubble in history, consider Tron, the cryptocurrency that's valued at over $7 billion, even though it doesn't actually exist. Then there's DentaCoin, the $1 billion digital currency you can only use at the dentist office. If none of this makes sense, don't worry. You are normal. Few people foresaw a year ago that Bitcoin's market value would go from $15 billion to more than $225 billion. And following a dramatic slide this week, even fewer people think it will last. After all, it's a payment system that still works so poorly, people won't even accept it at an upcoming Bitcoin conference. So what's going on? It's the same thing that happens anytime a new invention promises to change our lives. We go nuts. Technological breakthroughs simply cause a temporary separation from our rational selves. Digital currencies are no different. Everyone knows it's nonsense, but everyone thinks they can be the second to last person to sell and make a killing. It's a fun game until the music stops. But it will. It always does. Understanding Walmart's wage hike. When Walmart announced last week it was giving raises or bonuses to all of its 1.4 million U.S. employees, it didn't take long for the political spinning to start, said Charles Fishman. Conservatives crowed that this was the trickle-down effect promised by President Trump's corporate tax cut. Critics of the famously stingy company were unconvinced, however, and pointed to news that Walmart-owned Sam's Club was firing 10,000 people as the reason why the company might be engaged in political spin. And indeed, there are reasons to be skeptical that the decision to raise wages stemmed only from the tax cut. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon said the tax bill inspired the company to accelerate a few pieces of our investment plan, as if raises had already been planned. That would reflect the reality of the job market, which is getting tougher for employers. The fact that the company is rolling out generous parental benefits, including 10 weeks of fully paid maternity leave for full-time employees, suggests it understands it'll have to fight for employees going forward. The Sam's Club closures are also arguably a far-sighted move to keep repositioning Walmart against Amazon, not a sign that bonuses were political payback for Republicans. At the end of the day, Walmart looked at its tax windfall and decided to give some of it back to workers. Whether you buy the cynical explanation or the charitable one, that's encouraging news. Our in-depth article this week is titled, Growing Old Without a Pension. U.S. companies have been eliminating traditional pensions for decades, said journalist Peter Wariski. But it's becoming clear that many Americans simply can't afford to retire on Social Security and savings alone. Tom Coomer has retired twice. Once when he was 65, and then several years ago. Each time he realized that with just a Social Security check, you can hardly make it these days. So here he is at 79, working full-time at Walmart. During each eight-hour shift, he stands at the store entrance, greeting customers, telling a joke, and fetching a buggy. Or he is stationed at an exit, checking receipts and the shoppers that trip the theft alarm. As long as I sit down for about 10 minutes every hour or two, I'm fine, he said during a break. Diagnosed with spinal stenosis in his back, he recently forwarded a doctor's notes to managers. They got me a stool. The way U.S. major companies provide for retiring workers has been shifting for about three decades, with more dropping traditional pensions every year. The first full generation of workers to retire since this turn offers a sobering preview of a labor force more and more dependent on their own savings for retirement. Years ago, Coomer and his co-workers at the Tulsa plant of McDonnell Douglas, the famed airplane maker, were enrolled with a company pension. But in 1994, with an eye toward cutting retirement costs, the company closed the plant. Even though most of them found new jobs, they could never replace their lost pension benefits, and many are facing financial struggles in their old age. A review of those 998 workers found that one in seven has, in their retirement years, filed for bankruptcy, faced liens for delinquent bills, or both, according to public records. Those affected are buried by debts incurred for credit card payments, used cars, health care, and sometimes the college educations of their children. Some have lost their homes, and for many of them, even as they reach beyond 70, real retirement is elusive. Although they worked for decades at McDonnell Douglas, many of the septuagenarians are still working, some full-time. Laverne Combs, 73, works the midnight shift loading trucks for a company that delivers for Amazon. Ruby Oakley, 74, is a crossing guard. Charles Grover, 70, is a cashier at Dollar General. Willie Sells, 74, is a barber. Leon Ray, 76, buys and sells junk. I planned to retire years ago, Sells said from behind his barber's chair, where he works 5 days a week. He once had a job in quality control at the aircraft maker and was employed there 29 years. I thought McDonnell Douglas was a blue-chip company, but then they left town, and here I am still working. Thank God I had a couple of clippers. Likewise, Oakley, a crossing guard at an elementary school, said she took the job to supplement her Social Security. It pays some chump change, $7 an hour, Oakley said. She has told local officials they should pay better. We have to get out there and the traffic, and the people at the city think they're doing the senior citizens a favor by letting them work like this. Glover works the cash register and does stocking at a Dollar General store outside Tulsa to make ends meet. After working 27 years at McDonnell Douglas, Glover found work at a Whirlpool factory and then at another place that makes robots for inspecting welding, and also picked up some jobs doing AutoCAD drawing. "I hope I can quit working in a few years, but the way it looks right now, I can't see being able to," Glover said recently between customers. "I had to refinance my home after McDonnell Douglas closed. I still owe about 12 years of mortgage payments." For some, financial shortfalls have grown acute enough that they have precipitated liens for delinquency bills or led people to file for bankruptcy. None were inclined to talk about their debts. "It's a struggle, just say that," said one woman, 72, who has filed for bankruptcy in 2013. "You just try to get by." The notion of pensions and the idea that companies should set aside money for retirees didn't last long. They really caught on in the mid-20th century. But today, except among government employers, the traditional pension now seems destined to be an artifact of U.S. labor history. The first ones offered by a private company were those handed out by American Express, back when it was a stagecoach delivery service. That was in 1875. The idea didn't exactly spread like wildfire, but under union pressure in the middle of the last century, many companies adopted a plan. By the 1980s, the trend had profoundly reshaped retirement for Americans, with a large majority of full-time workers at medium and large companies getting traditional pension coverage. Then corporate America changed. Union membership waned. Executive boards, under pressure from financial raiders, focused more intently on maximizing stock prices. And Americans lived longer, making a pension much more expensive to provide. The average life expectancy in 1950 was 68, meaning that a pension had to pay out only 3 years past a typical retirement age of 65. Today, average life expectancy is about 79, meaning that the same plan would have to pay out 13 years past typical retirement age. Exactly what led corporate America away from pensions is a matter of debate among scholars, but there is little question that they seem destined for extinction, at least in the private sector. Even as late as the early 1990s, about 60% of full-time workers at medium and large firms had pension coverage. But today, only about 24% of workers at mid-size and large companies do, according to the data, and that number is expected to continue to fall as older workers exit the workforce. In place of pensions, companies and investment advisors urge employees to open retirement accounts. Once they reach retirement age, those accounts are supposed to supplement whatever Social Security might pay. Today, Social Security provides only enough for a bare-bones budget, about $14,000 a year on average. The trouble with expecting workers to save on their own is that almost half of U.S. families have no such retirement account, according to the Fed's 2016 survey of consumer finances. Of those who do have accounts, moreover, their savings are far too scant to support a typical retirement. The median account among workers at the median income level is about $25,000. The U.S. retirement system and the workers and retirees it was designed to help face major challenges, according to an October report by the Government Accountability Office. Traditional pensions have become much less common, and individuals are increasingly responsible for planning and managing their own retirement savings accounts. The GAO further warned that many households are ill-equipped for this task and have little or no retirement savings. The GAO recommended that Congress consider creating an independent commission to study the U.S. retirement system. If no action is taken, a retirement crisis could be looming. Employees at McDonnell Douglas in the early 90s enjoyed one of the more generous types of pensions, known as 30 and out. Employees with 30 years on the job could retire with a full pension once they reached age 55. But as the employees would later learn, The generosity of those pensions made them, in lean times, an appealing target for cost cutters. Those lean times for McDonnell Douglas began in earnest in the early 90s. Some plants closed, but for the remaining employees, including those at Tulsa plant, executives said, there was hope. If Congress allowed the $6 billion sale of 72 F-15s to Saudi Arabia, the new business would rescue the company. In fact, the company said in its 1991 annual report, it would save 7,000 jobs. To help win approval for the sale, Tulsa employees wrote letters to politicians. They held a rally with the governor of Oklahoma, and eventually in September 1992, President George H.W. Bush approved the sale. It seemed that the Tulsa plant had weathered the storm. The headline in the Oklahoman, one of the state's largest newspapers, proclaimed, F-15 sale to Saudi Arabia saves jobs of Tulsa workers. But it hadn't. Within months, executives at the company again turned to cost-cutting. They considered closing a plant in Florida, another in Mesa, Arizona, or the Tulsa facility. Tulsa, it was noted, had the oldest hourly employees. The average employee was 51 and had worked there for about 20 years. Many were close to getting a full pension, and that meant closing it would yield bigger savings in retirement costs. One day in December 93, they came out on the loudspeaker and said, "Attention, employees," Coomer recalled. "We were going to close. We were stunned. Just ran around like a bunch of chickens." A few years later, McDonnell Douglas, which continued to struggle, merged with Boeing. But the employees had taken their case to court, and in 2001, a federal judge agreed that McDonnell Douglas had illegally considered the pensions in its decision to close the plant. The employees' case, presented by attorneys Joe Ferris and Mike Mulder, showed that the company had tracked pension savings in its plant closure decisions. The judge found McDonnell Douglas, moreover, had offered misleading testimony in its defense of the plant closing. The judge blasted the company for a corporate culture of mendacity. Employees eventually won settlements. About $30,000 was typical. It helped carry people over to find new jobs. But the amount was limited to cover the benefits of 3 years of employment, and it was far less than the loss in pension and retiree health benefits. Because their pension benefits accrued most quickly near retirement age, the pensions they receive are only a small fraction of what they would have been had they worked until full eligibility. People went to work at these places thinking they'll work their whole lives there, Ferris said, noting that the pensions held great appeal to the staff. Their trust and loyalty, though, was not reciprocated. The economic effects were, of course, immediate. The workers, most of them over 50, had to find new jobs. Some enrolled in classes for new skills, but then struggled to find jobs in their new fields. Several found jobs at other industrial plants. One started a chicken farm for Tyson. Another took a job on a ranch breaking horses. In interviews with more than 25 former employees, all but a handful said their new wages were only about half of what they had been making. Typically, their pay dropped from about $20 per hour to $10 per hour. The pay cut was tough, and it made saving for retirement close to impossible. In fact, it has made retirement itself near impossible for some. They must work to pay the bills. A few said, though, they work because they detest idleness and persist in jobs that would seem to require remarkable endurance. Combs, for example, works the graveyard shift, beginning each workday at 1:30 a.m. His days off are Thursday and Sunday. He worked 25 years at McDonnell Douglas and more than 20 loading trucks. He shrugs off the difficulty. "I don't want to sit around and play checkers and get fat," Combs says. "I used to pick cotton in 90-degree heat. This is easy." Coomer, too, even if he would have preferred to retire, seems to genuinely enjoy his work. At Walmart, his natural cheerfulness is put to good use. When he sees someone looking glum, he tells them a joke. "Why does Santa Claus have three gardens?" so he can ho, ho, ho. People really like that one, he says. Along with his Walmart check, he gets $300 a month from the McDonnell Douglas pension. Had he been able to continue working at McDonnell Douglas, he calculates, he would have gotten about five times that amount. After they shut the plant down, I would dream that I was back at my McDonnell Douglas and going to get my pension, Coomer recalled. In the dream, I would try to clock in, but I couldn't find my time card. And then I'd wake up. In the dream, he would have retired years ago. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the health and science page now. The lead article there is aerobic exercise prevents heart aging. There is hope for middle-aged couch potatoes, reports Time.com. Years of inactivity can take a significant toll on the heart, but new research suggests that a spell of regular aerobic exercise can make up for decades of sitting. Researchers at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center recruited 53 people between 45 and 64 who were healthy but led a sedentary lifestyle. Some of the volunteers were placed on an aerobic exercise regimen involving several 30-minute sessions each week, one high intensity, two to three that were lighter, and one for strength training, as well as an hour of tennis, cycling, running, dancing, or brisk walking. The remaining volunteers were given a casual program consisting of balance training, yoga, or weightlifting three times a week. After 2 years, those who completed at least four aerobic workouts each week were not only markedly fitter, with an 18% improvement in their oxygen intake, but their heart muscle was also 25% less stiff, reducing their risk for heart failure. The second group benefited from neither effect. Exercising only two or three times a week didn't do much to protect the heart against aging, says senior author Benjamin Levine, but committed exercise four to five times a week was almost as effective at preventing sedentary heart aging as the more extreme exercise of elite athletes. Our suffocating oceans. Climate change, agricultural runoff, and sewage are dramatically reducing the ocean's oxygen levels, choking marine life and threatening millions of people who rely on the seas for food and income. That's the worrying conclusion of a major new study that examined all existing research on ocean oxygen loss, reports NationalGeographic.com. The researchers found that dead zones, swaths of ocean containing no oxygen, have quadrupled in size since 1960. Dead zones and other low-oxygen areas now encompass more than 12 million square miles of ocean. Overall, oceans have lost about 2% of their oxygen over that period, some 85 billion tons. Coastal dead zones are generally the result of fertilizer and sewage running off the land into the sea. But the cause of the wider deoxygenation is climate change. Warmer water not only carries less oxygen, but also fuels the metabolism of sea creatures, increasing their demand for oxygen. This can cause them to suffocate or migrate to nearby ecosystems where they could disrupt food webs or become more vulnerable to predators. Adding to the problem, microbes that thrive in low oxygen conditions produce high levels of nitrous oxide, a greenhouse gas more harmful than carbon dioxide. This is a global problem, said lead researcher Denise Breitberg from the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. It requires global solutions. And we're on the talking points page now. We will start with House Republicans rushing for the exits. Republicans are stampeding out of Congress like panicked wildebeest, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. So far, more than 30 Republican House members have announced that they'll be retiring at the end of this term, more at this point than in any recent election cycle. It's not hard to understand why. With President Trump's approval rating mired in the 30s, Republicans know they're facing a midterm bloodbath, especially in moderate suburban districts in blue states, where the tax reform bill is also toxic. No incumbent wants to wage a brutal reelection campaign he's likely to lose. Even Republicans who are in highly conservative districts are calling it quits, anticipating a massive loss of power under a Democratic majority and Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The mere thought is enough to send a congressman running to the waiting arms of a K Street lobbying firm. This is President Trump's nightmare, said Mike Allen in Axios.com. With a Democratic House, Trump faces not only a high risk of impeachment proceedings, but hostile chairs with subpoena power who can tie up the administration with hearings and document requests. In the modern era, the president's party has lost an average of 32 seats during the first midterm elections. Democrats only need to flip 24 seats in order to win a majority. Some forecasts have Republicans losing more than 40 seats, with recent polling showing that voters prefer Democrats for Congress by a 10-point margin. With numbers like that, it's no wonder that 8 GOP committee chairs aren't running for re-election. You don't climb to the top of power in Congress and leave unless you feel confident your reign will soon end. Americans are prepared to throw Republicans out of power not because of their record in office, but in spite of it, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Even though the economy is strong and ISIS is being defeated, many voters are repulsed by Trump. People are sick of the wild-eyed tweets, bigoted outbursts, and all-consuming chaos of this administration, and they're looking for someone to punish. A wave election is almost surely coming, said Peter Hamby in VanityFair.com. Democrats could, of course, snatch defeat from the jaws of victory by nominating terrible candidates or getting bogged down in fights over identity politics. But the 2018 midterms will be a referendum on Trump, and Trump will not change. We know that. Medicaid requiring enrollees to work. The Trump administration is about to embark on a much-needed Medicaid experiment, said the New York Post in an editorial. For the first time in the program's 50-year history, the federal government has agreed to grant waivers allowing states to impose modest work requirements on some Medicaid recipients. Beginning in Kentucky, with 9 other mostly red states lining up to participate, any enrollees who are able to work, excluding pregnant women, children, the disabled, and the elderly, will now be expected to get a job, do some volunteering or training, or prove they are caregivers. It's about time, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com. Medicaid's original purpose was to provide health care to strictly defined groups, including poor kids, the blind, and the disabled. Obamacare transformed the program into a sprawling entitlement covering 11 million more people, including able-bodied, childless adults of working age. Don't be fooled, said Judy Solomon in CNN.com. Team Trump would have you believe this move is about incentivizing work. Yet Medicaid beneficiaries who can work do work. About 80% of able-bodied enrollees work or have spouses who work in jobs without medical benefits. They rely on Medicaid to stay healthy enough to keep working. The rest are low-income individuals who suffer from a mental or chronic illness, are in school, take care of family, or simply can't find a job. These vulnerable Americans will be left without health care when they can't meet new bureaucratic requirements. That's the real motive for Republicans, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. Small government conservatives see kicking people off Medicaid as a good outcome. And to justify this approach, they need to paint recipients as undeserving, slothful moochers. Here comes another legal battle, said Amy Goldstein in the Washington Post. Under the law that created Medicaid, waivers can only be granted if they assist in promoting the objectives of the program. That is, providing health care to low-income people. The Trump administration is trying to get around that requirement by stating that productive work and community engagement may improve health outcomes more than simply being able to see a doctor. Liberal advocacy groups doubt that rationale will survive legal review and vow a challenge. Like so many other policies the Trump administration has tried to push through, this one is headed for the courts. And a couple of shorter notes as we wind up the show. By 2050, 9 of the 21 cities to have hosted the Winter Olympics will likely be too warm to ever host the Games again, climatologists say. Researchers identified Sochi in Russia, Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany, and Vancouver in Canada as among the host cities where winter temperatures will be too mild to sustain even artificial snow. For the first time in history, healthcare has surpassed manufacturing and retail to become the largest source of jobs in the U.S. Factors behind this trend including an aging population, increased public subsidies for medical care, and healthcare's relative immunity to globalization and automation. And we'll wrap up with a quote from Muhammad Ali. He said, "If they can make penicillin out of moldy bread, they can sure make something out of you." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you'll listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. 832-5138.